Razor Beats.
It is episode 4 of the Tuesdays with Laserbeak podcast. I am Laserbeak.
And I'm Jaka.
Bam.
I feel like you know us by now.
Yeah, exactly.
We're 4 episodes in.
We're 4 deep. It's no problem. How you doing?
I'm good. I feel like we're pros now that we've done a live event.
Yes, we knocked out. So the Luther album release party happened. And that was one of the most memorable nights of my life.
Me too.
Wow. That's 2 for 2.
Yeah.
I couldn't be more proud of Jaka, who I had to keep reminding myself in the moment of being a total stress ball that this was her first time like on a stage doing a hosting / performing thing.
Yeah.
You killed it.
Thank you.
Standing ovation for Jaka.
Listen, the fans are what keep me going. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, it was really great. It was, I feel like there was just like so much love in that room that night where it was this big like Laserbeak appreciation party.
Yeah.
Like there was a lot of love for you.
I felt the appreciation, which I also appreciated. And it was like, I had a big vision for it. And then in the moments before it happened, it was like, you just forget about what's going to actually go down. But like every single member of Doomtree was there. Paper Tiger flew in and surprised me.
That was really nice to
which
see.
Which is so sweet of him. And, you know, we got the gang back together. We did TTBT to end the night. And then like Sophia Aris and Bionic and Longshot and Joe from Mixed Blood Majority, Jeff Allen from Plastic Constellations, mm-hmm. my dumb kids actually pulled it off, and we covered a Trolls song and they crushed it. It was incredible. Then they fell asleep within 30 seconds and were carried out of the room. It was pretty amazing. I led the room in a guided meditation.
It was really something. So we were supposed to do meditation based on like the Headspace app, which is what Laserbeak uses. If they want to sponsor us,
yes,
we're here.
Absolutely.
But the internet stopped working
the second
you started the video.
I thought so. The first half of the night was great. The kids performed.
So smooth.
It doesn't matter at that point. Once your kids perform, you've got the audience. They're in there. And then all the Doomtree guys each did a solo song. We come out of the intermission and we go straight into just mental health and mm-hmm. meditation. And I was like, oh man, am I losing people? I think I'm getting them back. We're about to hit the meditation thing on my computer and the internet doesn't work. And then God bless Tommy, my brother-in-law, just yelled out like, you do the meditation.
Yeah. And everybody was so on board. Like everybody was really in it, and they were like, yeah, we'll shut our eyes, we'll chill out
really
for
did
a little
it.
Bit.
It's us and like 350 people just meditating.
It was really great.
It was powerful. It was a relief when it was over.
Yeah.
And but yeah, that was such a tight night, and thank you, Jaka, for hosting it and holding my mm-hmm. hand throughout the whole thing.
It was really fun.
And now Jaka is a international superstar.
It's true. I have been getting a lot of requests for, you know, to be on shows and all this. I have to keep turning them down because I'm busy. But,
she's busy. We're only 4 episodes into this podcast.
I know. We're still working things
out. There's a lot to be done.
No, as somebody who just like was a fan of Doomtree before all this, to then like get to be up on stage and hang out and backstage and like see all that, it was very surreal. And at one point I was backstage and Sims was like, you know, when I heard that it was you doing this, he's like, I was so glad that we found a way to make you a part of the crew. And I was like, oh,
Sims,
so nice.
Okay, sentimental. I love it. And speaking of, what the green room was actually just like a tiny tiny little teardrop trailer basically.
Yeah, which Penny thought I lived there.
Yeah.
Your daughter thought that, like, we walked in no prompting and she just goes, oh, this is your house?
Yeah. Penny's pretty sure that Jaka lives in like a 10-square-foot Airstream trailer in the back of an alley.
Which, I don't know what that says about me.
I feel like shots were fired at you from Penny.
I know, but I wasn't hurt by it because I was like, ah, oh, she's adorable.
She thought it was cool, actually.
So it was
a compliment. And we did end the night with a Pizza Hut pizza party in that thing.
Which, that pizza,
that was a
in hindsight, was, yeah, a mistake and very gross.
That was a mistake.
We got kicked out of the bar because of that pizza.
Yeah, that's a problem. But yeah, so the last episode was all about Luther. Again, thanks a million for everybody that has been showing love and support for that record and everyone who came out to the release show. That was amazing. And then I celebrated by going to a Timberwolves game and then throwing a birthday party for Lou and Cam, who turned 5. And then I escaped to Portugal.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. Laserbeak Escape to Portugal is going to be maybe a movie.
That is a movie. That's a Tom Cruise movie.
That could be a Tom Cruise movie. Coming our way. We know Tim Nelson will be watching that one. I went with Sims and his wife and me and my wife and DJ Fundo, and Dessa was there for half the time, and our good friends Jordan and Romani were there. It was like 8 grown adults with no children. Incredible. Traversing the coasts of Portugal. It was outrageous. And I haven't had that. I came home. Yesterday was my first day back at work, and I had 4 different people on phone calls tell me, like, hey, man, you sound different. You sound happier.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, maybe I need to go on vacation once a month.
Right. And just, like, disconnect from the phone. I remember, like, you emailed me something, and then I emailed you back, but I started it with, don't answer this because you're on vacation, yeah, and then said what I had to say. Yes. I was like, ignore this until you're done vacationing.
This was the first time, I think, in, I can't remember how long, that I was able to, like, not check the emails and things like that. Partly because the release show was over, and partly because it was so beautiful that I was like, what am I doing? I got to be in the moment. So it's hard to do.
Right.
But I feel like, oh my God, got to turn the phone off sometimes. Or you let your phone die, which I hadn't done in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And then you really have no choice but to not look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, or you force yourself to leave it at home. That's what I've been trying to do lately. If I go out on a walk, or if I'm going out with friends and I know that we all have our phones on us.
Yeah.
I don't need mine.
Exactly.
We're fine.
Someone's got a phone.
Okay. We're okay.
I love it. How have you celebrated? What did you do?
I've honestly just been working a lot.
Cool. I haven't. Sounds relaxing.
I think I'm at the workaholic age where I just want to establish my career. And so that's kind of my focus right now, is doing this, doing other podcasts outside of this.
Banging it out.
Working at NPR.
Yeah.
Yeah, just doing the whole thing.
Doing it.
But also trying to prioritize mental health too, you know?
Yes.
Trying to give myself time.
Some of both. Well, right now we are holding the POS Chill Dummy stress balls.
And I've never felt more chilled in my whole life.
We're going to give one to Mark Malman when he comes on later.
Yeah.
Who is going to be our second guest of the podcast, our good friend Mark Malman, who just put out a book called The Happiness Playlist.
It's incredible.
And we're going to get into a ton of things with him. But before he stops by, any bonus jams, Jaka?
Oh, yes. I've been listening to Teyana Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
The song Rose in Harlem, particularly by her, is incredible. She just came up on a daily mix for me. It was like that day in particular, a lot of like R&B and soul was coming up, and I was like, man, I really love all this. And listening to Willow as well, and all that. The new Dessa song, obviously.
Pretty good.
That goes without saying, but
good plug.
Yeah.
But new Dessa song, Great School Games. I like Willow a lot. Willow, it's Willow Smith, right?
I don't know.
I think
you
it
said
is.
It is, but I have.
I'm pretty
have
sure
no
it
idea.
Is. Willow, get the internet to fact check that for us. And Teyana Taylor's great. Have you heard the Kehlani record?
I haven't yet.
Oh, God. So it has replaced the Ariana Grande record for me currently as like the thing I can't stop listening to.
Okay, but will it surpass it? Because you already said Ariana Grande's album is album of the year.
Well, I know. I was preemptive with that.
You were really quick
with that. It was only February at the time. It's hard to say. This Kehlani record is just a mixtape that she made. She's like 8 months pregnant right now, and she whipped this up. It's called While We Wait, which is a great title for someone who's about to release a baby into the world. But I think she just did it as like a stopgap release, and it ends up being incredible. She got like Music Soul Child as a guest on the first song. So it is just like classic R&B with a new spin, and it's my favorite thing ever.
Yeah.
Other than that, I read Mark Malman's book, and that's been like the thing I've been thinking about a lot. So I cannot wait to like deep dive into everything that he's got to say.
And
about
I'm sure
it.
He'll have plenty of bonus jams for us.
Oh yeah, we'll get into it. All right, let's do it.
Yeah.
Wow. Holy cow. What an honor.
We are here with Mark Malman.
Hi.
Hello.
Second guest ever on the Tuesdays with Laserbeak podcast.
Really? Second guest?
Dessa number one.
First loser, second place, first loser.
Dessa number one, just to warm you up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. You know? She opened for me on the podcast.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Sorry.
Now for our headliner.
No.
Come on.
No. Yeah. This is it.
Mark Wallman. And it is release week for you, baby.
It is. Yeah, the book. I released a book.
Holy cow.
Onto the world.
Yeah, you did. The book came out. You're listening to this and it's, what? It's April. But the book came out 2 days ago.
It came out on March 19th.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
The book came out on March 19th. It's called The Happiness Playlist.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my aunts already have it. What are they calling me?
What's the review? What's the text thread look like?
My aunt Jean called me today. She's retired and she's a lovely woman. And she said, "You missed your calling." I know.
That's nice to hear.
You're never too old.
I was like, well, I mean, I guess, but I feel like I did some music.
Was she referring to that the book was good, or was she like, missed your calling altogether? You shouldn't.
I hope she was trying to say that the book was good and that I should be a writer instead. Yeah.
Well, you might be. You might be making that transition right now.
I don't know. Well, I mean, you are a writer of music as well.
Yes, so. You certainly are.
I don't know.
I guess you didn't miss it by that far.
I don't know. It's funny, though, and she's sweet, and we talked for a long time. So the book did, like, my friend Steve, you know, Marsh, he said, when I said, should I do this? Should I write a book? And he said, "It's no matter what happens, it's going to open up doors." And that was a door that it opened up, which was for me to have a long conversation, like a half an hour conversation with my Aunt Jean today, which is awesome. It's the longest time we've ever talked.
There you go. So if nothing else, you and Aunt Jean are tight.
That's all it matters. You know what? It's kind of worth it.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So write a book just so you can talk to your aunts.
Talk to your aunts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm trying to think of like the best way to intro, because I really want to get into the stuff in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe we just talk a little bit about Mark and I guess how...
How did you guys meet?
Yeah. Oh, how did we meet?
Can I say?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, how much do your listeners know about Plastic Consolations?
A little bit.
Do you know about them?
I do now because of the release show.
She had to do her
you
research.
You remember them?
Tim,
they
barely.
They were this kick-ass indie rock band. They were like post-slacker... kids, and they would kind of sing nerdcore.
Yeah, a little bit.
They had a song about dragons that was their most popular song.
Absolutely.
And their energy on stage was crazy. I mean, they were just crazy. They were so great, and I loved them. And I was young, and they were young. And we played shows together. Yeah. And then...
Mark put us up. He basically... Yeah. I mean, we were in high school still, and you... To us, we're still like an elder statesman or a guy in the scene or whatever. So we got, you know, when we get Mark asked us to open up for him, we were like, oh my God.
And hit the big league.
Yeah. And we played a lot together. And that was in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
And then I believe you guys played a marathon, right? Two marathons.
I stopped in. So for those of you that don't know, Mark has done these marathons. How many have you done now?
Well, four. We did three that were long form concerts all at the Turf Club. And then a fourth that was across the country. That was longest musical webcast ever.
Ever.
Wow.
People.
Well, the longest. No, I shouldn't say that. The longest transcontinental.
Woo.
The longest first moving nonstop musical webcast ever. I forgot what it is.
Man.
But.
That sounds fancy.
It's some record.
We did it in the back of a van, and we drove from New York to L.A., stopping in different cities and having guests in those cities come on in the van and jam with us, play with us.
Amazing.
And when it was, yeah, and then I was using EEG MIDI USB headset while I slept. That was invented for me by one of the engineers who just released the Moog One.
Hey.
And at that time, he was still in college, and he hacked and made a sleep monitor that would read my brain while I was sleeping and dump it into Ableton and make a MIDI signal live.
Oh, my gosh.
Of dreams, yeah.
Crazy.
And it was in Wired and stuff, and that was the fourth one. The other ones were straight-up rock concerts where I would hallucinate. And
yes, you would play for at least 24 hours.
26 the first, 52 the second, and 78.
So I think I then played on the first one because I remember going to the Turf Club Clown Lounge at like 10 a.m. on a Saturday mm-hmm. morning.
Yeah, it was all in the lounge. Yeah. That one, yeah.
And there was pancakes had been brought to Mark.
Yeah, I remember the pancakes.
He was yeah. on a piano and I just plugged my guitar in for like an hour and a half.
It's one like of nobody in there.
Yeah, there's like three people.
Yeah.
One of them, the people who made the pancakes. And mm-hmm. But yeah, so, you know, this is like, this for me is big. This is like I'm coming out of high school. It's my first introduction to any sort of kind of music scene in the Twin Cities. We grew up in Hopkins, the band that I played in. And so anyways, Mark was like a saint to kind of take us under his wing and let us play with him. So that is our...
You know, thank you. You got me thinking about pancakes.
Oh, and, let's go into it. Let's talk about it.
Were you ever at Paisley when they served pancakes?
I've never been to Paisley.
Oh man.
I've never ever been there.
I've never been to Paisley.
Tim never had the Paisley Park pancakes?
Oh my God.
Holy.
You did it?
Oh yeah. I mean, there were nights when there would be parties and they would be serving pancakes and with syrup and they put the butter in the syrup together.
Oh.
Man.
When would they bring this? Is this like 6 a.m? It's been dance party all night?
No, I think I had my first batch like at about 10 p.m. one night.
Wow.
Wow.
Had him a few times. It was towards the end of the part of the parties when he was still alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
just
fun.
He loved pancakes.
Who doesn't?
I know, it's true.
Right?
It's true. My kids asked me to make them 3 times a day, every day. How about pancakes tonight?
My sister-in-law does this thing where she puts chocolate sauce on the pancakes.
In them or on them?
On them instead of regular syrup.
That's what I do.
She puts chocolate syrup because it's actually less sugar.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
It doesn't absorb into the pancake like maple syrup does.
Yeah.
It's a hack.
Damn.
A kid hack.
You know what? We had, so fast forward, whatever, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We
had pancakes at
we
hard times.
We had pancakes at hard times. Mm-hmm. We got back together, me and Mark, and we split a pancake.
Mm-hmm.
Just one.
Just a big one, though.
Yeah.
A really big one.
It was great. And we hadn't, it's not that we had been apart in our hearts. It's just that our lives and our genres kept us moving in different directions.
Yeah.
And I had been touring so much for 10 years and it kept me out of the city. And then we met at a wedding again and we hung out and did Peace on Earth.
Yeah, we did. So we met. We were like, we hung out at this bachelor party actually of one of the characters in the book.
Mm-hmm, maybe.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially.
Perhaps.
Then we were at the wedding and we're like reconnecting and it's like, yeah, we should totally get some lunch. What are we doing? Got some lunch and ended up having like a really meaningful, I think it was, for me at least, it was realizing that someone else had been on a similar journey in a different way and had been battling with some issues and we were both kind of like coming out of it and seeing the light a little bit. And then it was just like, well, let's try to make a song then, I guess.
Yeah, and I had this song already sitting around. And it was like I didn't know what to do with it, and this was it. Just was like perfect match for what we were talking about, and we did the song, and there was a cool video.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I'm really proud of that.
It was the fastest music I think I've ever been a part of, which I very much love. Wish it all worked that way. He sent me piano and vocals on one day. The next day, I made stems, sent them back, and I swear to God, like the next day, you're like, here's the first mix.
Yeah, when I'm doing movie trailers, I'll get a call and they'll be like, are you busy? And I'll say yes or no. And if I say yes, they'll be like, all right, we need this and this in 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that's...
Let's go.
So it is about... My life is sometimes about turning tracks around.
Yeah. Well, it worked out really well. And then, then it just like came out 2 weeks later and it was just so cool to be a part of a process that happened from start to finish like that.
So how did that song feel for you, Beak, when you like got it? Were you like, oh yeah, this is perfect?
I was so excited.
This fits everything.
Yeah, because you know we talk, and this will happen too with other musicians. Like sometimes the talking part is great, and then there just isn't the connection with the music, and that's still like that's not a bad thing. It just doesn't always work. But with this one, with this instance, it was just like the song came through. I immediately got it and felt like I had something to add to it right away.
And I think like, I don't know, for me, of all the songwriting partners that I have, it never works when I get in a room with somebody and try to write a song. Mm-hmm. I'm just so used to being alone in my studio that I usually have a songwriter send me like half of the song and then I'll send it back. And you know, like I'm used to throwing it.
Totally. Going back. And I am too. Like it's so boring to watch my process with like trying out different sounds and all that stuff that every time someone's like, yeah, we should make the song together. I'm like, oh God.
Mm-hmm.
And then I psych myself out because I'm like, you're just gonna be watching me, you know, dig through snare samples for the next 3 hours or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so I do love the togetherness and the apartness.
Yeah, yeah.
And we bring it back together. Yeah. And I think we nailed that with Peace on Earth.
Mm-hmm. I think ideally in like a collaborative situation regarding like modern recording, you could have like two separate rooms where you're both working on two songs at once and you just swap every, you know,
yeah,
that could
totally
be cool. But mm-hmm.
tag in. And that was also the first holiday song. It felt like a holiday song to me.
It does feel like a holiday song.
Because it came out around the holidays.
Yeah.
But I have, especially as I've gotten older, I've become a lot more, I don't know if it's nostalgic or if having a family or what, but the holidays, I get really amped about it. I get amped about holiday music, which I never used to. So it felt good to like contribute to something that felt in that vein.
I had done one holiday song with my old band, Ruby Isle. We covered some song from Nightmare Before Christmas.
Awesome.
I do believe this Christmas thing. And I don't remember it anymore. But I felt like this time in our culture, I wanted to make an inclusive song that really didn't, I don't feel there's enough. I know just the idea of Christmas, it hits me in a nostalgic way, but it also bothers me in a cultural way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like the idea of celebrating. I think we should celebrate more as a culture and as a, you know, like a community. So for me, it was like, oh, this is kind of do the peace thing.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
as inclusive as possible.
Yeah. And it's like, it's needed.
Yes.
Right now, like positivity is.
Yeah.
We can't afford to be like dark right now. We will be again. But
yeah, we'll get there.
Cycles through.
We'll come back to that. No question. Okay. Well, yeah. So that's me and Mark.
Well, okay. So you and Mark, that's great. But Mark, I want to know a little bit more about like a brief history of your career, which I know is like hard to sum up, but of like, how did you get into music? When did you feel like, oh, music, this is like what I want to do?
I my mom got a piano when she was three, or when I was three.
She was very well off as a three-year-old. Right.
And so I still remember seeing her taking lessons. And then I started lessons when I was five. So I started playing when I was three. And then I started playing jazz when I was 10, still just piano. And then I started writing pop songs when I was 11 and got a 4-track when I was 13. And I started playing covers and then I learned rock. And I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so there really wasn't too much outside of Milwaukee. And I don't want to say it's a cultural vortex because it's not. It's an awesome place. But the radio station that I had access to was like a KQRS kind of thing. It was a classic rock station. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like where my sort of style came from. I went to art school to MCAD here, which is what brought me here. And so I kind of was learning about turning things inside out, really into Andy Warhol and Cindy Sherman and some postmodernists. And I started applying that to what, like, the idea of classic rock. And so turning it on its head, just, like, by nature. So then I was writing songs. I would imagine I had about 700 songs recorded by 22.
Wow.
And I hadn't played it out.
Dang.
Yeah, I hadn't played out. So I got a job, and I realized I worked at the Walker Art Center. I was working with all these really creative people, and I realized that these creative people weren't able to follow their hearts because they're taking the bus and it takes them 2 hours to get to the Walker, and they were painting really small when they wanted to paint big. And I realized, okay, I put all my art supplies away and my music supplies away, and I said, I'm going to get a job that pays well. So I ended up I got an editing job at Channel 4 and editing the morning news. And I didn't take my visual art stuff out of the boxes. I just took my music stuff out.
Yeah.
And I started writing an album, and I recorded an album, and it took off. And it took off in the press, and I started a band, and the band took off. And then I started doing performance art. And then 2002, to a label saw me at South by Southwest, and they ended up signing me a good sized indie songwriter label, and put 2004 put out 3 records, and I toured America about 6 months a year from 2003 till 2013, and sometimes in Europe. And I've been putting out records and doing marathons and scoring movies and writing commercials and scoring movie trailers and DJing. And for a while I had a cover band, and I've been trying to explore like every corner of music just to understand what and why and become stronger on every level.
Yeah.
And then things happened where I lost a parent, and then I just quit music for a while so I could heal. And that's what inspired my album, The End Is Not the End. And that in turn inspired what is now the Happiness Playlist.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, so.
That was an incredible.
Yeah, that was a really good summary.
I wish that I mean.
I was really ready for like having to guide you in that, but you were like, you had that. Like, but
you tapped into an energy there. And
well, yeah, that was really impressive.
That was awesome.
But so I've read the book. I loved the book.
Thank you.
And I marked Thank some you. Quotes that I particularly liked. And so what you were just saying reminded me of one of the quotes in the book that I'll read. It says, "In order to write what you know, you must go out and get to know things. Build a mountain of truths over time. This way, the last song you write will be the result of every song you've ever written. Make certain to sing through your mouth from your heart, not with your mouth from nowhere. Let the content reveal the intent, but be responsible with your artistic karma. Make even the angry songs beautiful." And like that idea of having the last song you write be a culmination of mm-hmm. everything that you've written before. That's mm-hmm. I feel like I've never heard artists reflect on it that way, but that's a very interesting way to think about songwriting. And do you feel like that continued in your book? Like, do you feel like your book was also a culmination of like all the writing that you've done previously?
I think if we're living truthfully and aware, our artwork, what we make, is inevitably a reflection of everything we've learned, because life changes us, and so it's a narrative. Was that a yes or no question?
Yeah, you said yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he nailed it. Well, and especially when you've written well over 1,000 songs now. You have
and I have a lot of library songs that are constantly on MTV and stuff, and so I've been able to research the form.
Yeah.
And I when I said write from your heart through your mouth, not from your mouth to nowhere, I think that what I'm meaning is the technique that I use when I write, especially lines that I end up using over time. I've learned that if I listen and then I play what I hear in my head. I don't play until I hear something good. I don't like sing until something good comes out. I listen to what's not there. And then I like, it's like a picture. If I tell you like picture a house in your mind, now draw what you see. You're kind of channeling the totality of your brain, the subconscious and the conscious mind, you know, and maybe this weird psychic place, this magical electrical place that music comes from. But I found that it's more efficient to listen than play than just kind of play and wait.
Yeah. Sure.
And how does that compare to like your process? Because that sounds like it's totally different.
That sounds like a beautiful process. I feel like I have to, I need the spark to be something that's already there. It's like oftentimes where it will be like a sample or a found sound or something that sparks the idea, as opposed to, it sounds like you're almost the opposite. You're like, are you listening to nothing? And being like, I feel something.
I just
now?
Wait. It's not that it's not that mystical. Sure. I mostly just wait, and in my head, like if I wait right now. So what I just heard was do 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 do.
Amazing.
And so then I just do 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 do.
Sure. And then you
so I just hear it and I play it, and the same is true with improvising. If what I've learned is I don't get a very good solo if I'm ahead of the solo. So if I'm thinking and playing, but if I hear in my head the solo, my do 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 do, and I'm do 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 do, and following that, it's always good. And I don't know why that is, but I think it might have something to do with bypassing logic and reason.
Yeah, totally. And complete Yeah, freedom. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think people connect with that more, but everyone's process is different, you know, because we're all different people.
Absolutely.
So
there was the process in going from writing an album and thinking of an album as 10 or 12 songs to, holy shit, I'm going to write a book. What does a book even look like? How long is this book? Like, were there similar things that you fell back to on, like, just the way that you've processed creating in the past? Or was this a whole new...
No, I had to do it that way. But one thing I realized is I kept getting something that had never happened for me in music and songwriting, which is a type of writer's block. Mm. But it was more like I didn't know the book I was going to write where, like, with this listen play thing with like writing a melody, I just wait. And I'm so in tune with music because I've been doing it every day since I was a boy.
Yeah.
It just, I can hear it and I play it. It's not, I don't know where it's coming from, but that doesn't matter. But with the book, I was like, maybe more like you, I have to get raw materials.
Yeah.
So I just journaled. I said, okay, well, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to listen to these happy songs for 6 months. Even if I get sick of them, I'm just going to listen to them and I'm going to just write what happens every day.
Yeah.
Just keep a diary. And then I'll make it into a book once it's done, you know?
Yep. So was that, was the idea for the book prior to you turning to happy music? Or was it, oh, wow, I've been turning to happy music. Now this actually feels like something I want to develop more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It wasn't like when I have an album, like right now I'm writing a funk album and it's like, what am I going to sing about? You know, I'm constantly thinking about that. It was this thing where I had developed what some doctors said is post-traumatic stress disorder because of a trauma that happened like a year and a half earlier. And it like pushed out my amygdala to just like release all these fight or flight chemicals.
Yeah.
And so I would get scared by like anything. And certain things would pull me out, you know, and one thing that would pull me out from, and it wasn't a psychological thing. It was really physical scared. And so, I found that like if I put music on that was like had the word gun in it, I would just freak out.
Yeah.
So I needed, so I like put a Bob Marley song on, and that worked. And I'm like, okay, I like Bob Marley, but I don't love it. But it's working, so I'm gonna leave it on.
Yeah.
And then through trial and error, like responding to my body, just a body response, what was happening maybe happening in my brain, but it really with PTSD, it was a physical.
Yeah. The whole body tenses up.
I was going into like fight or flight. So I was, what music is like, and it would put me in a cool spot because I was able to do this kind of litmus test, but I didn't know I was going to write a book about it. I was just like, how can I get out of this zone?
Survival.
It wasn't survival. But I was able to eat, but then at the same time, like there were times when I was like hiding in the corner. I'd have to people all over and I wanted to get out of the nightmare.
Yeah.
And I was having nightmares when I slept and you know. So then I had this playlist and it was cool. It was like one of the tools that I used, right? And along with developing like a sleep schedule and some more healthy living habits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And remembering that like you can control to a degree, you can control your brain with your body to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so the playlist got evolved and evolved and evolved. And then when I really got a mastery on my new lifestyle, which was totally different than it was, you know, because I wasn't drinking, I wasn't having caffeine, I wasn't performing, and I was like reading a lot of like spiritual stuff, but I was getting these self-help books from my dad and they weren't helping. They were like too thick. Mm-hmm. And then I would feel guilty because I didn't finish it.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
Or they were like the secret where it was just like, this is like a pyramid scheme to sell more books. And I would just throw it in the garbage.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So then I had this opportunity to write a book a while ago. Someone said you should try it. It was not an opportunity, but someone said you should talk to this guy. He owns a book thing. He would love to work with you. I didn't think about it. And then I said, you know, I should write a book for people like me. Something that talks about grief but is funny. And something that talks about music and isn't heavy and doesn't have any triggers in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had a plan going in. And then by that time, I was using the playlist all the time. So I was like, oh, cool. I'll just write about the playlist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I have a friend who is, not to interrupt you, but I have a friend who is a poet by profession. He's published on Penguin Classics. And and he's a classicist, so he translates old text. And he told me the raw materials must be perfectible. If the raw materials aren't perfectible, you can never achieve perfection with your project. I love this idea. So when you come up with the impetus of an idea for something, you know, like, I'm going to write a werewolf movie.
Yeah.
If the idea for the werewolf movie isn't perfectible, you'll never write anything good.
Sure.
No matter what, you'll be polishing, you know, what a turd, like my dad says. But so I knew that this was a solid idea.
Yeah.
I knew that I could. And then I had some other book ideas, and my friend was like, don't write those other ideas. This is the easiest one.
Yeah.
And so you talked about sort of like the connection between like body and mind. And one of the things that I noticed in the book is like a love for happy music and also like a love for dancing. Like, do those two things coincide, where like dancing being, is that something that you feel like helps you as well? Like, helps you with your mind, and does happy music play into that?
Yeah, I was talking to my Aunt Jean today on the phone.
You certainly
and
were.
She was a nurse her whole life. And she was saying, when she worked in the psych ward, which is what she said, one thing that they said to people to do was, right when you get up in the morning, put on music you like and dance.
Really?
And I don't know if it was something, maybe it wasn't tied to the psych, I'm not positive, but she had told me this thing, and maybe it was grieving her husband, but I learned from the cover band, from being in the cover band, not from DJing, like the real karmic power of dance, because when you're in a cover band, you're not the main attraction. When I'm Mark Mallman, like, that's one people pay to see. And when I was in the cover band, you're like the bartender, you're like the door person, you're there to facilitate their night, and they would want to dance, and you would have to play songs that would keep them dancing. And you see how the dancing is bringing them together to hug and clap and cheer and meet people they might like go home with, and then going home with them, they might end up starting a family with that person, because you know, how many people meet in a nightclub, you know? And it's the music that brings you in, and it also lubricates the energy between people. But I also, Beak, you know, like when you're in the studio, a lot of times we respond to the music by moving when we're mixing, and that's how you know it's good.
Yep.
All of a sudden you look around, everybody's moving. Do you mix too? Or?
No, but I listen to a lot of music.
She listens to a ton of music. But yeah, you know the feeling when you're creating something. And I have this both in when I'm making a beat or something, and then when I'm in the studio and there are other people around, and you pick up on the vibe of like, there is a physicality to it.
Yeah.
This book, and you talked about, it's kind of a 6 month, covers around 6 months.
Does it cover 6 months?
And we live in a state that is very cold, and a lot of times our winters are 6 months. So I read that book, and I felt like, and I read it towards the end of one of the most brutal winters I've experienced here in the state of Minnesota. And so that book, to me, it feels like it's a winter book. It's you surviving the winter and surviving a lot of other things. We just got out of this winter, man. Like, Mark texted me this morning with a picture of the sun coming through and was like, holy shit, man. Like, it's really melting. And it does feel like, I just got back from a trip a couple days ago, and the city feels so much lighter than it did the week before when I left. And there's so much power in that. I don't know exactly what question I'm getting at, but did you feel that in the book? Was there any correlation of like seeing the seasons change throughout that?
For sure. I mean, it's like, you know, poetry sort of 101, like Robert Frost writes a poem about winter, and your English teacher says, you know, winter represents death.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Or Frank Sinatra singing about the September of his years. And so, you know, it was kind of like storyboarding a documentary before it happens. I'm like, okay, it's going to happen in winter, because then I can have rebirth of the seasons, you know, and I didn't know what was going to happen with my relationship, but I knew my mom wasn't going to come back to life.
Yeah.
You know?
And I guess real quick, for people that haven't read the book, the trauma that we've kind of referred to is you losing your mother.
Right.
And then suddenly, and then kind of what happens after that for you in dealing with that, mm-hmm. basically, right? Yeah, I mean, that's what kind of brings upon.
I think,
ish.
You know, I mean, it could be just overusing my cell phone that screwed up my neurotransmitters.
Sure.
But mm-hmm. what I was told by a medical professional was this thing called postponed grieving, which is hard for me to accept because I don't want to blame my mom
sure. mm-hmm.
for something that happened to me after she passed away, you know? But so that that a year and a half later, that something flipped in my head and all of a sudden I woke up frightened and I didn't let it stop me. And I didn't believe that it was going to destroy my career. And a lot of people say, well, I didn't even know anything was going on.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I'm not going to use it. I'm just going to figure it out. And, you know, I'm an entertainer and that's my job, to be professional and go on stage and be funny and be a rock and roll musician.
Right. Yes.
So,
but inside there's a whole different isolation and turmoil.
Yeah.
And...
But I thought, well, okay, I can figure this out. I can get past this and I can get on with my life and I won't give it power over me, but I will let it do what it's doing so I know how to control it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, and are obviously very different situations, like what led me to my kind of rock bottom with anxiety and stress and actually acknowledging that I needed help or something was really wrong was certainly not the loss of a loved one. But it was in that moment, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it felt completely debilitating. And mm-hmm. I didn't know how to talk about it. And I didn't know, it was so scary because you don't know even how to identify it. It's just this all encompassing feeling. And it wasn't, but I did find like comfort, at least in being around other people. It was like when I was by myself, it was an absolute monster that I couldn't contain. But when mm-hmm. I was with other people, I at least was able to find some comfort in that communication and bouncing off ideas and just being around friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love in the book how often you kind of rely on a few characters just mm-hmm. to, it's not like it doesn't solve anything, but it feels like it kind of softens things a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any solving?
No.
No.
In life?
Yeah.
Anyways.
It's a great
just
question.
Really is just being.
Yeah.
And if you're busy solving, you're not busy being.
Yeah.
And if you're not being, you're not really living. But you know, in regards to what you went through or what I went through, these are things that everybody goes through. Everybody as a human being loses people, you know, it's either they go or you go.
Yeah.
So you know, they experience the afterlife and you experience the after death of that person, and, or you know, you mourn, everything from getting a tooth pulled to your child reaching a certain age, or maybe you mourn a career that technology has eaten or something. But we all do different levels of grieving. And there's one thing that happiness playlist can do is it's light and it's simple and it allows you to use it in all those different times. You know, it's not like it's so simple that it's just one tool that can help. And it's not all the time, you know, it's not like you're not going to crank like Death Grips anymore. It's just saying sure. that sometimes you got to just, like, you know, put on some Stevie Wonder and get your head straight and then it's cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the idea.
Totally.
Yeah. There's a moment in the book where there's sort of one song that creeps in that is not a happy song. It's a Phoebe Bridgers song.
I sent that to you, didn't I?
Yeah, you sent me your top five sad songs.
Oh,
I sent my top five back.
You told me that.
But you sort of reflect on whether the happiness playlist was a way of like making yourself not feel those emotions, or if it was like what service it served. So how do you feel about that now that you're like, you've had some time from that? Do you feel like the happiness playlist like allowed you to heal, or was it a way to not feel certain things? Like, how do you feel like it worked for you?
Well, if you're managing fear and you're trying to heal yourself from fear, any fear, the basic idea is to slowly expose yourself to that fear. And then you'll know how much for instance, for me, a long time I couldn't watch scary movies when it was real bad. But now this summer, I watch Alien. I was like, oh, I can watch Alien. Then I watch Aliens, and I watched more scary movies and Annihilation. And then,
oh God, that's a good
one. Then I watched 1408 with John Cusack, and I stopped. And I said to my friend, okay, that's the scariest I'm going to go. I'm really glad that I got that far, but I'm not going to go scarier than that, at least right now. So, with the Phoebe Bridgers song, it came at a perfect time. I hadn't expected, I hadn't expected my mind to be blown by a song because it doesn't happen much anymore. And then suddenly this song got released called Smoke Signals, and it really blew my mind to the point of me going, you know what, I'm just going to listen to this. Because at first I was afraid to listen to it because I thought, what if I listen to this song and it sends me into a backward spiral, sure, and I have nightmares in it? Like, what if it triggers something? But that's my anxiety talking.
Yeah.
That's the fear talking, you know, the fear of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear wants to fear, you know?
Yeah.
And if you take that fear away from the fear and don't give it what it wants, you know, it's fear is so reasonable and it's so rational because it's tied to your ego. So it makes a lot of sense to listen to fear. And also fear is necessary. It's how we've evolved and it's how we survive. So it's learning how to balance those two things. But I thought that was an interesting point. And since I was kind of, like I said, self-writing a documentary as it happens, I thought, well, this would be a great point in the book to acknowledge that happiness is not exclusive and there's a place beyond happiness. And there's also, you know, that is a turning point in the book. You know, if it was a movie, that might be the break into three, because you realize I've got power over the bad guy. Now I'm going to kick his ass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and I adore that song.
Yeah.
I adore her as a songwriter.
Yeah. She's wonderful.
She's really good. She's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a moment? So I know the process of finishing an album and the glorious elation that you feel when you've okay, now we're going to take it to mix, but the songs are done. Or when you do get the final mix and you're about to go to master, before you hate it. I don't know what it's like to, finish the book. Like, was there a day when you, wrote the last sentence and you were like, oh my God, it's done? Or then you were just waiting for your editor to be like, it's not done, man.
Well, first of all, I don't hate my records. I can understand where, maybe if you're shooting a video, definitely I'll hate a song because you hear it so many times in a day. But what's cool about writing a book is in this town, sometimes it's hard for me to, now I have Ed Ackerson who I work with, and Ed and I know each other, but for a while it was hard for me to find somebody who would say no in the studio, because they'd be like, oh, you can, you know, you're Mark Mullman, you make your records however you want, just do that. And when I meet with Ed, he says, no, there are too many sounds in here. That Mellotron is out of key. And I go, I want that out of key. And they're like, you don't want a Mellotron out of key. And I'm like, yep. And he'll go, ugh. And then we fight.
Yeah.
But we fight friendly and respectfully, and we make a better record. And this case, I had an editor, and I had for making the big cuts, and he cut the book in half.
Did he really?
Yeah. And it was, my ego felt violated.
Yeah.
But my friend said, here's the thing. You're right about what your editor did, but your editor is right about what he did to the book. So you're just going to have to accept it as a new book. And now when I look at it, he made all the right choices. So what's cool about the case of writing a book is you, at least in this case, I finished it. I gave it to the editor and I got something else back. And then I reshaped that and gave it to him. And then I got a little more, and we slowly arrived at what it is, the book. Because he was able to see my vision clearer than I could, because I was...
Yeah.
You're too in it.
Yeah. I suppose the same way that a lot of mix engineers are like, I don't want to master this. We'll give that to someone else.
Maybe.
Different ears or new eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I wish I had someone to do that with my life. I wish there was a place I could go and throw all my life decisions and have them say, edit it, and you're screwing up.
Yeah,
you're screwing up,
Is that therapy?
I was going to say,
is that therapy? I kind of think it is. Like. I just got out of marriage counseling this morning, and I was like, it kind of felt like that a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, they're at least steering you in the right direction.
Right.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Hopefully they don't cut it in half ever. Yeah. Right?
I want it to be like I Heart Huckabees, where they have an existential detective agency or something.
Yes, totally.
So I think the length of the book, it's the thing that impressed me about the book is, so I love reading, and I'll read, I will take on an 800 page mammoth of book. I love it. But I was so surprised by like how much you were able to pack in this book, because there's like such an exploration of music and a real sense of place. Like, I've never read a book that I feel like captured, especially obviously I live here, so it's like it captured Minneapolis so well. And it felt like every word was so intentional. But I want to talk about that idea. Like, you really, it's like a love letter to Minneapolis in a lot of ways, and to like Minnesota and the music scene here. And so how much of that was like intentional, and how much of it was just like truly how you were feeling at the time?
The intention of the love letter part was conscious. The idea was, when I was in therapy before I started writing the book, but I knew I was going to write a book, my therapist would start talking about sailboarding. And how he loves sailboarding so much.
Is that when you're standing on the board and you're kind of paddling around? Okay,
Yeah, paddleboarding. That's it. Paddleboarding and sailboarding. And he would describe the beach just for like 5 minutes when we start the sessions. And I was like, after a while, I'm like, God, I love these times where he just talks about the sun and the beach and what he did. And I realized, oh, wait, he's been doing this for like 38 years. He's starting me with a guided meditation to chill me out. And I was like, I'm going to do that in my book. I'm going to make it a guided meditation, so that when you read the book, you hear these like pleasant descriptions of things like tea or like a smell that's nice or a taste that's nice. So your body responds, I think, you know, at least for me, my intent was so that the reader's body responds and relaxes them while they read it. Because a book that really inspired me was a comedy book called The Stench of Honolulu, and it's just a bunch of one-liners and strung into a narrative. But I found that whenever I read it, I felt a lot better than I did with these self-help books. Mm-hmm. So it was important for me. That's why I wanted to put happiness in the title. And so that part is intentional.
Yeah.
The other part you said to
that question? It's just a sense of place. You really, like, you were able to really ground the book in this, like, sense of place.
I think you were talking about the efficiency of language.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just because I didn't know how to write a book. I knew of the books that I liked. And I read The Old Man and the Sea, and I thought, I hadn't read it since high school, and I thought, the first line in the book is, there was an old man. Like, that's how the book starts.
Perfect. Yeah,
totally. And I liked that. And I thought, you know, I'm going to have I'm going to allow myself two things. I'm going to be descriptive and really short, and then I'm going to write poems, and then just take the poems and make them into paragraphs, and then I massage them into one thing. But I wanted it to be like these short sentences, so it would be an easy read.
I think it made it so impactful. Mark sent me the book a little bit before it came out, so I was almost texting him as I was reading it, which I don't know how many people have done that. That might actually be annoying, but it was so, I think when you read this book, it feels very personal, but I feel like I'm in it with you and walking with you in that journey. And so those things, like those little happy thoughts, are like the way you would describe writing a song on a Saturday, even in the middle of this, and the sun's coming through and you haven't had dinner yet, and like these really kind of tiny grateful moments, kind of the way that I think of how I do gratitude list every night.
Night I do it.
You know, it's like the most mundane shit, like, oh, I had an apple fritter. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Popped it in there. Like,
my dad's like, he's like, you know, if you look, you know, because my mom had major depressive disorder, so my dad guided her through it. They went through it together. So my dad is like a ninja in all these techniques, because she lived till she was 68 and she had it her whole life. And so he's like, Mark, and I don't have depression, but he still says things like, you know, if you think you had a bad day and then you make a list of everything that happened during the day, you realize that you probably only had like 15 minutes that sucked.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And then you had a donut and you had night with your friend and you went dancing.
Totally. A bird sang through the window.
The ego is super deceitful.
Oh, man. But I thought you were so... That I got those little tiny moments of joy. And I remember when I first texted you, were like, don't worry, it gets better. Like, it gets happier. And I was like, I don't feel bummed because you've been able to show me enough of these little things. And I think you use humor in a really great way that I've found too in my journey has been so helpful for myself. And just to talk about it with others is like, you kind of destigmatize things and you're able to kind of crack a little joke without totally ruining anything.
Thank you. Thank you for gushing and being complimentary. But I did want to write it so that people who were in a situation where they're bummed out wouldn't put it down. So that they could get to the happy ending and they could get, you know.
Yeah. And I think there was a certain aspect of like, for anybody who's been through anything like that, anxiety or grief or anything, there was an aspect of relatability, but not in a way that was so deep into here's how my brain feels awful. It was relatable in the ways that it played out in day-to-day life. And like, just, the mundane things really helped to describe like how you were feeling and how things were going. It was all the mundane things.
In songwriting, and I had said this in a different interview, but I'll change it a little bit. But in songwriting, if I were to sit down and write a song about that mixing board, and then after it I was going to write a song about how the state of the world is and my place in it, I have a feeling that the song about the mixing board would be more about my state of the world, because everything's implied, you know, and you don't really need to state your emotions and how you're feeling. You don't really need to be abstract. If you just like describe what's going on, it's in there, you know, and I didn't know if I had the skill as a writer to be complex in that way. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm just going to describe the room. I'm going to describe the streets. I'm not going to like overshoot myself by trying to write this big thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, lucky, I guess.
Yeah. And it was wonderful.
I know. We are gushing. I just realized we're gushing.
before you even got here, Beak and I, like, we just gushed. And when he finished reading the book, I was like, I had a copy as well. And so I was like, okay, I need to pick it up. And then I read it and I texted him after and I was like, it's so good.
It's on. I was like, we're getting him. We're getting him on this fucking thing. I basically read the second half of the book in one sitting with like my two boys asleep with their legs on my lap in bed. And I just, it was very, here we go. I'm just going to give you a hug right now, Mark, through the microphone. But like, I was just so impressed and moved. And it was like, I'm trying to get back into reading, but I don't read a ton. And so to be just like wrapped up in something and go through that was so tight. I texted him like right away. I was like, I've been crying and I really enjoyed it. And I was like, we got to go get pizza.
For sure.
Mark loves, what is it, green olive?
Green
and
olives and pineapple. Yeah.
It's yeah.
But see, there are people Tim out there who understand. But once I posted on Twitter and I got like ravaged for it.
You know, I saw when I was in Portugal, it was a pizza box taped to the wall and it said, say no to pineapple on pizza.
Mm-hmm. Like, I saw that and there was a dialogue
pop off about that. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, when we as songwriters, as musicians, will joke about this, like, you know, you'll post like, hey, my new album just came out. And like two people will be like, hey, good job, man. And then you say some shit like, I fuck with pineapple on pizza, and the whole internet pops in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone's got a real thing to say about it. But green olive added to the mix is a whole new level.
Man, I just follow my heart. I don't care if there's haters.
Yeah.
Is that how you've done it with your soup?
We got to talk soup. I'm sure you've gotten this
because that's a part of the book.
Soup is a part of the book, and so as it happened, what was cool. It's like I was thinking as life was happening. I was thinking, okay, I can bring that in, and I'll make that a thing, and I'll focus on that when I journal the next day. And I liked in high school when, you know, I didn't take college literature classes because I was focused on painting. But I remember in high school English, I was in that English for the kids that skipped out all the time.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, totally.
But it was still cool. And they were talking about the Grapes of Wrath and the Tom Joad and the turtle. And the turtle, I don't think I write about it in the book too, but the turtle like symbolizes the coming of the downfall of the family. And I like that symbolism, and I thought the soup could be symbolic of my relationship with my dad, because he buys it for me and sends it to me. And he's like, you're going to have a good time with this. And it's like, it's my dad. So
he buys you a crock pot.
No,
right?
I said soup. Yeah. He buys me a crock pot.
Yeah. He buys you a crock pot and sends it to you on some, like, I'm your dad. I'm going to help you through this.
Yeah. I'm going to help you through this. And he did. It was super fun. Super. And I Yeah. So it was fun to like, but I never ended up making a very good soup. I made some really bad ones. And
you talk about putting peanut butter into one.
Peanut butter and spaghetti sauce is a combination that I don't think anyone will agree with.
Yeah.
Tim just gave it a thumbs down.
Tim says no.
It's like a three-way. It just happened. I was just putting stuff in there.
It just happened.
It had worked.
Is that how it happens? That's how those happen? It just happens?
It does, for me. And then, so, like, the stuff was just there, and I put it in, and then I was like, well, peanut butter, it's just protein. I can't taste it. And my smoothies, I probably won't even be able to taste it. And up until then, no matter what I put in the soup, it always came out tasting like just kind of plain prison mush.
Sure.
And
delicious.
So this did not. It was horrible. But then what's cool about it was it used to carry on tour. You know, you've had a documentary crew follow you around on tour.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's cool about that is when something terrible happens, you're like, yes, it's going to be great for the documentary. So when I'm writing every day and I know I'm coming to book, I'm like, yes, I made a horrible soup.
Yeah.
It's going to be a highlight of the book.
It's going to be 3 pages.
Yeah, except for when the kids egged me. I was pretty ashamed of my behavior when I got home because I chased them in the car. Yeah. I was just so mad.
Yeah. Sometimes you kind of just flip.
I flipped. I'm so glad that like they got away, and I'm glad I didn't catch them.
It would have been a different book. It would have been
written from jail.
Taken a turn for sure.
I beat up high schoolers.
We would be. We would have to call the prison.
Yeah. No. So soup. Like I got to be honest. It was a brief affair. I don't.
You're not still doing it.
I did not bring the crock pot out all winter this year.
You didn't perfect it.
I never perfected it.
I can make a nacho cheese dip that will knock your socks off.
Okay.
It's Laserbeak's Lava Banger Nachos, and that's the only thing.
I have the recipe card. Yeah, you gave it to me.
I'll give you a recipe card before you leave, Mark. Okay. It's the only thing I know how to make in a crock pot, but I do it every year for the Super Bowl, and it is incredible.
Okay. Wow. All right, cool.
So that's it. So maybe you need to switch from soup to something a little more thicker.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you missed your calling.
Sure, I did.
Where's Aunt Jean right now?
Yeah.
You got an Aunt Jean. I have an Aunt Joyce. It's a nice Midwestern.
Yeah, I have an Aunt Joyce. Aunt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think everyone has an Aunt Joyce, maybe.
Maybe.
No. I have an Aunt Jessica.
There you go.
Oh, nice.
There we go. That's better. There's the J's. So I guess what, obviously people are going to read it and they'll take whatever message, but what, if you could have one thing that everybody could take from it, what would it be?
That joy is within your reach and the universe holds you in the palm of its hand. You're going to make it through. Breathe. And you can get through some of this by taking some of the control away from your brain. If you just develop your own systems, and you don't need one system, don't focus on the problem. Focus on the solution. It doesn't matter what caused it. What matters is that you're in shape to eat another grilled cheese sandwich. And tomorrow is going to hold beautiful things, and just keep going. Surround yourself with positive people and people that lift you up, and love yourself. And if you can spend time with animals, spend time with animals. And if you can't afford to listen to a crappy song, then put on a happy song.
Hey,
that is probably the most poetic podcast ending this ever been.
I'm going to just loop that over and over again every morning.
Your new meditation.
When I doubt myself, that's my new meditation every day. That's my mom and minute. It's really, really good.
Your book, Happiness Playlist, is out in the bookstores.
It's an indie book, you know, so you can go to an indie bookstore, like subtext in St. Paul or something and purchase an indie book.
Yeah.
And it's all going to like
where it should go.
Where it should go. There's yeah. no, you know, it's there's that's all I'm many, saying to sell
less,
it.
There's less yeah. pockets.
There's less pockets. There's no evil empire.
I could not recommend it enough. The second I was done reading it, it was like, we got to get Mark on here right away because mm-hmm. I just feel such a strong connection to it. And I think it's a universal message. And I think anybody going through anything at any time can relate to it. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say
thanks for all this time.
Oh, dude, thank you for writing it. I really am excited for you and for this kind of new level. I feel like you leveled up.
I don't know.
Ajin feels like maybe it's not a level up. It's kind of...
Ajin's like feels like I should have been doing this a long time ago.
Ajin's kind of pissed right now, actually.
Why are you doing that?
Mark?
I know. Why didn't you write a long time ago?
Yeah.
But it's book of the year for me, and I know it's only March or April or whatever the fuck, but get it. Happiness Playlist, Mark Mulman, second guest ever on the Tuesdays with Lazy Week podcast. You're the best.
Thank you. You're
Thank
the best.
You, so
you both are the best. Tim is the best.
Tim is the best.
Thank you, Tim.
All right. He had to hear this.
Right. Theme music.
Theme music.